So where were we? So we were understanding what are the dimensions and operators with good dimension in n equals 4 super young Mills. So this was the most fundamental object in a conformal field theory. And what did we learn? We learned that the good operators, the operators with a good anomalous dimension, they take this kind of nice form where I take one of the scalars and I think of that scalar as being some sort of vacuum, say the Z field by convention. And then on top of that vacuum, I will put some scalars, say x, for example, at position n1 and n2. I give them some momenta by writing the wave function in Fourier. And then what I see is that I have two magnets, two excitations, x, with momenta p1 and p2, that move in the chain and scatter in the chain and so on. And what's remarkable is that we can generalize this ansatz, which for two particles is a trivial consequence of energy and momentum conservation, to any number of excitations and still write what is called the beta ansatz. And those states diagonalize exactly the one loop dilatation operator that we computed. And the diagonalization turns out to be nothing but, turns out to imply nothing but a set of beta ansatz equations, which are a set of algebraic equations that I remind you have the meaning of you take a particle, you carry it around the ring, scattering with everyone else, that's this product over k not equal to j, and the total phase should be equal to 1. And once you quantize the momenta of your excitations in this single trace, you compute the energy by summing the energies of these excitations. We also saw, but we never played much with, we also saw that this SU2 sector was a subsector of a larger sector where we considered all the possible scalars of the theory. That was the SO6 sector, where we have not only the identity and the permutation, but a new structure called the trace. And yesterday in the tutorial, you played with yet another sector, which is the sector where instead of having two kinds of scalars, you have one kind of scalar Z, and you have any possible number of covariant derivatives in a given light cone direction acting on that field Z. Okay? So this is another kind of spin chain where at each side, I can have an integer K at each side. And that K takes the value 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. So it's an example of a non-compact spin chain. Were we to repeat the computation that we did for the SO6 sector, computing the ultraviolet divergence, seeing what we get, and so on, this is the Hamiltonian we would end up with. So it's an Hamiltonian, where instead of identity and permutation, now we have more possibilities when we have these derivatives. When we have these derivatives, we have a term where the derivatives don't move. So if I have two derivatives in one side, three derivatives in the other side, they don't move. And the coefficients of this was these harmonic numbers, h, right? And then there was a term where some derivatives jump either to the left or to the right, and they are weighted with -1 over the number of derivatives that jumped. Okay? Now, if I understood correctly, people were struggling to verify that a given state was an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. Namely, there was a state that I wrote, which I claim was the primary, where you sum over, you make a linear combination of operators that have derivatives on the first side and on the second side, and you sum over all possibilities. There was a typo, there was a 1 that of course should be a 0 to have symmetry between the first and the last side. And the claim was that this operator should be an eigenvalue of the dilatation operator. Okay? So suppose we act with the Hamiltonian on this state. Okay? Is this familiar to everyone, or did someone miss the tutorial or something? Can I go on? So you act with Hamiltonian on this state, and you collect the coefficient of the ket, coefficient of the ket k s minus k. So this is what we get. Let me show you. Please follow before writing. Lambda over 8 pi square. Okay, that comes from the prefactor of the Hamiltonian. 2. 2 comes because you connect on site 1, 2 or 2, 1. That gives the same. You only have two length 2. Now, binomial times this, this is exactly this, times two harmonic numbers. This comes from doing nothing. Remember, doing nothing gives the sum of harmonic numbers. minus, and then you can come from the wave functions where you were shifted, and you can come from 1 to k. You could have nothing, you could have nothing here, and you could jump up to derivatives there. And you could have another sum where you hop in the other direction. Okay? So you have the terms where the derivatives are not in the right position and they are shifted to the left or to the right. So this is the sum that you would have to do. This is the coefficient of this k, s minus k, after acting with a Hamiltonian. And what would you like to get according to the tutorial? You would like to get lambda over 2 pi squared times harmonic number of s. This is the anomalous dimension of the operator, times the wave function, which is this binomial times minus 1 to the k. Is it okay? Yes? So what we want is to show that get is equal to 1. So how to do it? You write get over 1 and you apply full simplify. It's not a joke, but really. This is all you had to do. Just plug it in Mathematica. Mathematica does the sums. You get some harmonic numbers and so on, and apply full simplify. Okay? So it's not very complicated. Okay? Now you could ask, okay, Mathematica was able to do it. I should be able to do it. Right? What do I need to know to compute these kind of sums? So let me just give you a flavor of what is the kind of idea. Of course, it's perfectly okay to use Mathematica, but here is the kind of things that you would want to do. You want to learn how to do these kind of sums. Maybe you were struggling with doing these kind of sums yesterday. Okay? Should have asked Mathematica, but okay. You were struggling with this. But notice that if instead of 1 over d, you add x to the d, this would be trivial. This is just the expansion of the binomial coefficient. Right? But then, to get from here to here, you just integrate from 0 to 1. Okay. Is it okay concerning the comments on the tutorial? Very good. So now we have these sectors. And now there are two things we want to know. We want to know what is delta for more loops. We want to plot delta and more sectors. We want to study not only scalar operators, but any possible kind of operators. This is one thing. And finally, I also want to discuss today, we also want at least to discuss a bit the structure constants, which was the other important point. Okay? So let me try to divide the time evenly and discuss these three points in the remaining time. Let's start maybe by staying at one loop but going to more sectors. So let's start by the more sector one. For example, you could want to understand what is the beta zats for this SL2 sector. What do I mean by that? In this SL2 sector, it's exactly the same thing. You can have some z's, and then some derivative acting on z, and then some z, dz, z. And I can give this guy some momenta p1, and this guy some momenta p2. Write the wave function exactly the same as before. Maybe with a small difference. Can you tell me what would that difference be? What would you make? There would be a small difference in the ansatz that you would make there, if you would write it there. What would it be? Sorry? Very good. Whereas the axes, they are like hardcore particles, N1 must be smaller than N2, the derivatives, no, I could put smaller or equal. The derivatives can be in the same position. Okay? Otherwise, it's exactly the same thing. And then what we could do is, we could study one magnon, and from one magnon, get the dispersion relation epsilon of p. That's actually trivial. You see, if you only have one magnon, then the harmonic number gives 1, because it's harmonic number of 1 plus harmonic number of 0. That's 1. And then this one, where it hops, is 1 over 1, it's 1 as well. So for one magnon, you get the same as identity minus permutation, so the dispersion is exactly the same as before. Okay? So this is the same as before. Because for one magnon, this Hamiltonian for all practical purposes is the same as 1 minus permutation. Then you compute 2 magnons and you get the S matrix. And I gather that no one arrived at this point yesterday. Is it fair? So this was the last point of yesterday's tutorial, to just put 2 particles, act with Hamiltonian and compute the S matrix. So let me tell you what you get. What you get, if you do this exercise, is very simple. What you get is, so for SL2, let me underline in yellow, this is the same. Same expression for SL2, doesn't change as we discussed. The dispersion is the same. And the only thing that changes is something very minor here. Let me put an eta here and an eta here. And then the only thing that changes is that for SL2, I should flip that sign. Eta is equal to minus 1 for SL2. And that's it. So the S matrix is almost the same. It's just 1 over the S matrix. Whereas for SU2, eta is equal to plus 1 for SU2. Okay? So for example, solving the equations, etc., like we did yesterday, you just flip 1 sign. Okay? By the way, let me just make a comment that from the point of view of what kind of pictures we get in a complex plane, remember these beautiful shapes that I had, these nice contours? It makes a huge difference because you change the sign. So yesterday they were attractive in this direction and repulsive in this direction, the force. But now because of that sign difference for SL2, it will be the opposite. It will be again repulsive in this direction, like for the matrix model, and attractive in this direction. So that the cuts will be again real cuts as for the matrix model. Okay. So our naive blah, blah for yesterday would be correct for SL2. It was still just real cuts. Then there is another sector that we could have discussed, which is actually even simpler, which is called the SU1/1 sector, where the Hamiltonian is exactly the same. 1 minus, but let me put this P slightly curly. And let me tell you that this sector is the sector where you have at each side a Z or 1 of the fermions. Okay, so it's also like SU2, you have 2 kinds of excitations, Z or X, and now Z or fermion. The only difference is that the permutation acting on this guy gives psi and Z. But this is the super permutator acting on psi and psi gives minus psi and psi. So that would be the only difference if you compute a dilatation operator in for this kind of operators. Okay? Again, note that if you have a single excitation, this or the permutation is exactly the same, right? This is the same as a permutation. So for that sector, this nothing changes here. This is the same. The dispersion is the same. But now you can compute the S matrix. And someone wants to make a guess for what S matrix is in that case? We already used eta equal to 1, eta equal to minus 1. Okay, very good. Eta equal to 0. So you see this nice set of equations. They describe immediately 3 different sectors. We just need to choose a different one. This one is particularly simple. The S matrix disappear and you just have 3 fermions. You might ask, what about all sectors at the same time, operators that have all scalars, all derivatives, everything. That gives a more complicated set of bit equations, which are called nested bit equations. And I'll be happy to tell you more about it later. But this gives you a flavor of how it goes for more sectors. So let's now go to more loops. Okay? Let's go to more loops. So what would you have to do at more loops? Well, at more loops, remember, we have to correct the Hamiltonian. At more loops, we have to deal with these Hamiltonians that instead of being local, they start to be more and more non-local. Right? So what do we have to do at higher loops? One. We need to correct the dispersion. And also, we need to correct the S matrix. Okay? And there's one more point that, unless someone points out, I will come back to this next last point when I come to discuss three-point functions. But for now, this for sure we have to do. You see, now the particles N1 and N2, they are separate. They approach, they scatter. And the way they scatter, I need to recompute, resolve Schrödinger equation. The S matrix will become corrected. So the dispersion now, we will get some dispersion that will depend on the coupling and some S matrix that will depend on the coupling. Okay? So let me tell you, again, without derivation, as I said, today I want to give you a flavor of what is known, but we will have to sacrifice a bit derivation, simply because otherwise it will not be possible. Let me tell you how to do that. How to deform these bit equations to make them valid at higher loops. Notice that I introduced g squared to be lambda over 16 pi squared, so g squared is roughly the Tuft coupling. Okay, just for it's convenient to introduce this variable. And then, in this variable, sorry, here it's g squared. In this variable, what happens is that, so the bit equations are exactly the same. And the energy, I just made a part on this Lorentzian. So this Lorentzian here, u squared plus 1/4 is just the sum of u plus I over 2 and u minus I over 2. Okay? So nothing fancy here. So now I will tell you how to deform these equations and make them valid at all loops. And what happens is actually quite remarkable. So first, let me explain you how to correct the dispersion. So about the dispersion. So right now, we have that e to the ip is equal to u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2. And the energy is equal to 2ig over u plus I over 2 minus u minus I over 2. Writing this is the same, is equivalent to writing that energy is equal to sine square of p over 2 with some g square. This is equivalent to this, right? I'm parameterizing the energy and moment in terms of u. If I solve for u and plug it into the energy, this is equivalent to this. The generalization to all loops turns out to be quite beautiful, and it works as follows. Introduce a deformation of u that deforms u in the following way. U over the coupling g is equal to x plus 1 over x. So this map, x plus 1 over x, is called the Zhukovsky map. It's a map that people who do fluid dynamics use to study the airplanes, the wings of the airplanes, because it maps circles to airplane wing shapes. I don't know if some of you have encountered this map. This is called the Zhukovsky variable, so found by a Russian engineer. You see that for at very small coupling, the Zhukovsky variable is basically just u over g. But there's basically no difference between x and u. But of course, then there are corrections. Minus g over u plus dot, dot, dot. So this is a deformation. And of course, I can write explicitly, I can solve. It's a quadratic equation. So this is a deformation of u into x of u. Okay? And now, here is the claim of what you should do to get the dispersion, the energy of the excitations at all loops. Okay? So this is all loops. So all you have to do is deform it in this way. And now you can ask, what does the dispersion become in this case? And it becomes the following. So this is the dispersion once you write it in that way. Now, how could someone have guessed this? So first, people computed the dispersion up to three loops. So they computed the first three terms, okay? And then they made an Andrew-like conjecture. They saw the coefficients, and they guessed it was the square root. But actually, it's possible to derive the form of this energy purely using the supersymmetry algebra. But that, again, you will have to trust me on that. And it's possible, okay. So this would be what you would find if you start studying the energy of your excitation, computing one, two, three loops. And actually, this guy was computed up to five loops already. And up to five loops, you see that you get exactly the expansion of this simple square root function. Okay? At strong coupling, you find the same. And as I said, there are arguments by Bizard based on supersymmetry that if I had one more lecture, I would show you that allow us to derive this energy. It follows purely from supersymmetry arguments. Okay? Now, this is quite interesting. The fact that there is such trivial deformation of the dispersion relation. So all it means is that in our bit equations, concerning the part that is related to the dispersion, all we have to do is deform a bit the momenta here. That certainly we have to do. That's point number one. Okay? So it could not be simpler. With this, you can already compute the two loops and the. Okay, sorry. Now you could ask, what about this S matrix? What about the corrections to the S matrix? Let's parameterize the corrections to the S matrix by a function called sigma of uj and uk. So that we define this function as a function that starts at 1 plus ... and which takes into account the corrections to the S matrix. So this is what is called the dressing phase. Okay? Yes. Sorry? Yes? Yes, yes. At weak coupling? Yeah. To leading order? To leading order, you do. Of course. Okay, let me emphasize that point. Of course, when you take this, when you just keep this term, then we get the one loop result. You are right, but then there are all the corrections. Or here.
Okay, no. Here?
No, x of this argument. X of this argument, right? So this is x of u. Right? So this defines the function x of u. Is it clear? Yes, this is what I wrote here. P is this function of x. That's why in bit equations, all I do is replace u plus I over 2 by x of u plus I over 2. This is e to the I PL. And the energy just takes this form. You see, the only reason why I made a part in the Lorentzian was because then the whole loop generalization becomes very easy to present. OK, and then suppose you go and start computing this in perturbation theory. Okay? So people did it. So let me tell you what they found. You compute now the first correction, which will be of order lambda. So this is two loops. You see, it might be slightly confusing, but I hope it's not confusing. You see, this wave function here was the OA function obtained by diagonalizing the one loop dilatation operator. So there is lambda times an Hamiltonian. You diagonalize and you get this. Of course, there is no lambda inside. The function is of order one. So the corrections in the wave function, the stuff that is of order lambda, comes from the two-loop Hamiltonian, right? So when you write stuff, when you write lambda here, it's a two-loop effect, right? We did one loop, and of course, there is no space, no room for lambda. Lambda is just an overall constant in our Hamiltonian. It plays no role. Of course, we get order one wave function, order one bit equations, and so on. So this is what you would get if you do two loops. And if you do three loops, you would get lambda square plus tak, 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 right? And people did this computation. But what you find is really nice. Zero and zero. OK? So can you make a conjecture for what this sigma is? One. Very good. That conjecture is wrong. At four loops, you have something. But for a long time, it was hard to believe. How could you have a theory that was so mean to you? It would give you one, then zero, then zero, and then something at four loops. But that's reality. And here, you get something which is non-zero. Times lambda to the four. Now, we actually also know how to derive this dressing phase to all loops, to all orders in perturbation theory. And there, the technique is not based on supersymmetry. It's based on what is known as crossing symmetry. When you have an integrable theory, and you have particles scattering with each other, you can impose that the S matrix. You can impose crossing symmetry. You can exchange time and space and impose some functional relations on the S matrix that sometimes allow you to fix the S matrix completely. Okay? A nice physical way that I like to think about this is the following, and that was proposed by Beisert, is the following. Think that you have a particle just moving so that it doesn't scatter with anything. But it could also scatter with a virtual pair of particle-antiparticle with zero charge, zero everything. Zero charge, zero momentum, zero everything. But then you have an equation that tells you that 1 is equal to, now you create this pair-antipair, and this guy scatters with tuck times tuck. So you get 1 is equal to a product of S matrix times S matrix of antiparticle. And in that way, you get an equation for the S matrix. Okay? So there is a way of writing an equation that if you have a particle just moving in the vacuum where you have these particle-antiparticles, it's, of course, the same as if the particle turns out to cross the particle and the antiparticle. And that implies some sort of equation that schematically, very schematically, is of the form if you scatter with a particle or if you scatter with an time scattering with an antiparticle, you should get a total phase one. Again, very schematic. If I would like to be more rigorous, I would like to tell you how to construct the so-called singlet state and so on, but I want to give you the physical picture that it's possible to derive some sort of equation for this dressing phase. Yes? No, it's not. Sorry. It's a mistake. Thank you. And this implies some equation for the gamma, and that allows you to fix gamma, to fix sigma, sorry. And sigma of u and v, let me show you this mysterious function that starts at order g to the 4. It's given by the following. It's given by exponential of 2i times, there is an auxiliary function chi that depends on u only through this x and x of u, this Joukowsky variable. And what appears here is x of u plus I over 2, x of v plus I over 2. Okay? Let me call a function chi that appears with these two signs plus, chi plus plus. Okay? So please follow the notation. Okay? Is this fine so far? Now, the full result is the following. Then there is plus chi minus minus, minus chi plus minus, minus chi minus plus. So we are getting there. Now I need to tell you what is the function chi. So far, so good? Concerning notation? Where? Now here comes chi. Chi of x and y is given. Maybe let me start writing it Okay. It's given by a double integral representation where you integrate dz1 over x minus z1 over the unit circle. Integral dz2 over y minus z2 over the unit circle. Okay? Times log of gamma function 1 plus ig z1 plus 1 over z1 minus z2 minus 1 over z2 over gamma of the same thing with a minus sign here. Okay? So this is what it is. So this is the full result for the full S matrix of particles in n equals 4 super Young Mills at any loop order. No, this is the S matrix that appears in all sectors, but slightly decorated by some trivial factors. So we could use this for SU2, for SL2, for any. Okay, so let me pause and make sure. Is there any question? So again, how would you go about finding the dispersion relation? You would write the dispersion relation of a given particle, play with a supersymmetry algebra, acting on the states, and you would find out that it's possible to constrain the dispersion and fix it completely. How would you go about computing the addressing factor completely? You impose this nice physical equation, which is called crossing, which is the statement that if you manage to create a state which has zero everything, zero energy, zero total momenta, no color, and so on, which is called a singlet state, then scattering with this singlet state should be absolutely unphysical and immaterial. But that turns out to give a functional equation on the S matrix that once solved, and to solve it, you have to input some analyticity properties because there are many solutions, fixes completely the form of your S matrix. Then you can do something remarkable. You can expand it at weak coupling. You can compute what you get for the lambda to the cube term. And what you get is some zeta 3 over u minus v times a function of u and v. It's quite complicated. And it matches exactly with perturbation theory. No. At higher loops, we still have integrability. So if you have three particles very separated, they scatter first two of them and then two of them, and you still have totally factorized scattering.
I mean, like if particle one goes to three and three goes to one, they will meet with two.
Right. So you have terms, but that's not about higher loops. It's also about one loop, right? You have diagrams indeed, where the particles can scatter twice in the wave function, right? But that was given just by an S matrix, S12 times S13, right? So those coefficients of the wave functions, because the theory is integrable, all you have to know is the two-body S matrix. Okay? It's possible to write it in some sectors. So, okay, that's a very good question because we know the full solution, but we don't know what we diagonalized. Because we started using such fancy techniques like supersymmetry, then crossing, and so on, that at some point we don't even care about what the Hamiltonian is and we just get the solution. Then it becomes a bit problematic. We can say, here is the full solution of diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. By the way, I have no idea what the Hamiltonian is. And indeed, this is the state of the art. For example, in SU2, you know the Hamiltonian up to five loops, if I'm not mistaken. You don't know more. But you know the solution to all loops. This is what is written now in the blackboard. For SL2, I think maybe not even two loops. For SL2, maybe two loops are known, not three loops for sure. And for the full sector, I'm sure that the two loops are not written down for the whole operator. So you see that you have a no-loop solution, but really to see what you are diagonalizing, if you want really the analog of, say, SO6 or the full chain to all loops, you have no clue, which is quite fun. I mean, that's I like that. But as I will now explain, when I will move to three-point functions, we do now start to need to know much more about the details of the theory than before. And that's a very interesting area of research that will probably, as a byproduct, give us the Hamiltonian at all loop orders. So let me just say that this here, you can now use this corrected equations, put many particles, compute the energy of some state, and now plot the energy of classical operators, or of any operator for that matter. So you can now plot, using these equations, the anomalous dimension as function of lambda, as function of lambda. You agree? You just need now to solve slightly more complicated equations. And you get something. Then you get something at strong coupling. So this came from classical strings. This here came from Feynman diagrams. And then, now you can really compute and get something all the way. Okay? However, it turns out that this is the answer is not perfectly correct. It's very good in the beginning. It's very good at the end. But reality is a bit different in the middle. So this is the real result. There is something that is not captured by the beta and zats. And that is something that is not important at weak coupling, that is not important at strong coupling. It's something that only appears when you are in a very, very quantum regime. Let me now tell you what that something is. And it's very simple to understand. This picture here of particles that move and scatter and so on, it's very beautiful and it works if the operators are large. If the operators are large, indeed I put particles, they move freely and they scatter and so on. And all we have said is perfect. We have some S matrices, we compute them separated, we impose periodicity, we get bit equations, and so on. Now, suppose you start doing perturbation theory. The range of the Hamiltonian is larger and larger. And at order g to the 2L, which I remind is lambda to the L, I mean, this picture of particles moving in the chain and scattering with each other is totally wrong. Doesn't make any sense. At this order, it must fail. I have my chain and my particles. And now my range of interaction is as large as the chain itself. Right? So the particles are anything but free. I mean, they interact so long that they feel its own their own interaction. These are what are called wrapping interactions. From the string point of view, I have my cylinder and I have a virtual particle that goes around the string. Now, this is not in the bit and zats. But this clearly does not affect the two ends of the plot because it only starts affecting the weak coupling at very high order. If you have an operator of length 10, it only affects it at 20 loops, at the 10 loops. So of course, it doesn't touch the beginning up to very high order. It also doesn't touch classical strings. You need at least virtual particles to go around. Now, that's something very counterintuitive in ADS-CFT. You have a system, and you say, as I go to higher and higher loops, at some point, I start getting these wrapping interactions, and my treatment is invalid. But on the other hand, if you go even higher, you go to another classical description. But then it should be good again. It's very counterintuitive thing that ADS, CFT, you have a system that becomes more quantum, and then classical. But that's true. So this explains this part that is not captured by the bit and zat are this part which are related to this finite volume corrections. For that, we need an improvement of the bit and zat. And the improvement exists, and it goes by the name of thermodynamic bit and zat. So the green curve, the correct curve, would be what is called the thermodynamic beta and zat. So it's an improvement of the bit and zat that takes into account all these virtual processes that go around the ring and gives you the finite result in any integrable theory at any length and not only large lengths. Okay. Now, for some quantities, it turns out that this gap is zero for some quantities. So for some quantities, you can use what is here in the blackboard, and it turns out that these wrapping corrections are not important. For example, in the tutorial, you studied a function which is called the cusp anomalous dimension, remember? I told you that if you have this operator's trace of many derivatives and then many z's, but the derivatives are much larger than the number of z's, then the dimension of this guy is some function of lambda times log s plus dot, dot, dot. And this is, for s, really huge. Much bigger than j. In this case, there is a universality. And what happens is that provided you are at s much bigger than j, you don't care what j is. Okay? Because s is much bigger than j. But then you can imagine. Imagine you were doing some j, and wrapping would appear at 100 loops. Because the result is independent of j, you could increase j a bit and delay when wrappings would appear. It will only appear at 102 loops. But because it's independent of j, if s is big enough, I can go to 104 loops and so on. And then it turns out that because s is really the hugest, the biggest parameter, this guy is independent of wrapping correction. So it's a universal and independent of wrapping correction. For this quantity, you can really use the bit and zat and plot f of lambda. I remind you that this function, if you studied it at large s, these harmonic numbers are just sum of 1 over j up to s, right? So at large j, it is just, you can replace the sum by an integral, so it's log of s. Yeah, it's clear? It's sum up to s of 1 over j. So at large s, it's log s. So this goes, this function starts at lambda over 2 pi square. It goes to square root of lambda over pi, lambda over 2 pi square. And if you solve the bit equations in the SL2 sector at all loops, you do get a beautiful function that is totally correct. And that describes the energy, our first energy of an operator at all values of the kappa. In general, you have to go to this thermodynamic bit and zat, which is slightly more sophisticated. This concludes the spectrum problem. Any question? What about three-point functions? Okay, so more loops are done. You can go solve these equations and do amazing plots. Now let's go and study three-point functions.
Question?
Yes.
How do you know this right result?
How do I know the right result? Again, you have to develop a technique for studying integrable spin chains in finite length. If length is very large, we developed it. It's called bit and zats. If the length is small, there is an improvement of that idea that goes by the name of thermodynamic Bittensatz. If you want a single picture to try to give you what is the feeling of it, what is this thermodynamic Bittensatz, it's based on the following idea. Suppose, so about thermodynamic Bittensatz. Suppose we want to study the ground state energy of our system, of an integrable system. What do? You put your system, so this is our chain, and I'm putting it in a very big torus. So this length here is the length of my chain, and this huge direction here is the temperature that I put very small because I want to extract the ground state. So this would be R, which is 1 over the temperature that goes to infinity. This gives me E to the minus R times the ground state energy that depends on L. Okay? And for excited states, I have to refine a bit this to keep the next exponential. But let me stay with the ground state. Do you agree that if you do a path integral of your, say, string theory over this torus, when T is very large, it's what we did for the quark antiquark potential, you are computing the partition function and you extract the ground state energy. Is it okay? So the path integral over this big torus extracts the ground state energy. Now, okay.
I didn't get how you put the spin chain on the torus.
Don't put the spin chain, put the string.
Oh, it's just a string.
It's just a string.
Then I heard it wrong. Okay.
Sorry.
That, yeah.
Yes. You see, I alternate between spin chain and string. Why do I do it? Because they are the same.
Yeah.
But it's right. For the sake of the argument, I should have said string. So you have here your string path integral, and you want to compute, say, the ground state energy. So this is what you do. Now, this is space L, and L is finite. So if I want to compute a spectrum in this length, I can use the Bittensatz, but it will only be valid if L is large. If L is finite, it fails. There start to be wrapping corrections and so on that invalidate my approach. Okay? But then let's do something very simple. In the path integral, we have sigma and tau. Let's make a weak rotation and reinterpret this. Let's now think as of this direction here as being space and this direction here as being time. That's just going at our path integral and changing sigma and tau. But now what do you need to do? Now you have a huge space, so this space is huge. Because it's huge, the Bittensatz is exact. Here we can use Bittensatz. Now we solve this problem of not being able to use. Now we can, because the length is huge. But now the time is finite instead of very large. But that's okay, that just means that you are computing e to the minus this huge space, r, times the free energy per unit volume at some temperature, 1 over L. But the length is huge. So what do you have to do? Go to these bit equations, take some huge length, but now you don't compute one state. You have to compute many states and compute the free energy by summing over all possible states with their corresponding entropy. But to do that computation, you can use this, because the length is huge. So you overcame your problem of having a small space. You just traded space by time, and now you have a big time, a big space, but a finite time. That just means finite temperature. It means that you will have to sum over all solutions of bit equations. So you go from taking single solutions to now you need to solve the problem with temperature and compute averages over all possible solutions with some temperature. This is the basic idea. And you do that, and you lift this curve to the perfect result. And then, for example, you can do that. That, as Lucas pointed out, uses very much this string intuition. It's a bit hard to argue why this would be okay from the spin chain point of view. What does it really mean to change time and space and so on? From string, everything is okay. And therefore, there is a step that you can only do if you really assume ADS CFT. Because really, for this argument to be really clean, for a mathematician to buy it, you really need to have this nice, smooth world sheet that the string gets. So you have this argument, and you have this thermodynamic Bittensatz equations that come out, and now you compute the energy, say, of Konishi, and you predict what this wrapping interaction should be for, say, the smallest operator, this Konishi that we compute. And you do it, and it turns out to be a very simple computation from this thermodynamic Wittgenstein's point of view, and you get some number times eta 3, some other number times eta 5, and some other number, which is the rational number. And then Velogianin and also Sieg and company, they computed hundreds and thousands of Feynman diagrams. Literally, Velogianin did it in components. It was 110,000 Feynman diagrams. And he gets exactly the same number as the integrability approach predicts. So the spectrum problem, in that sense, is solved. There is a review which came out last year in December, which is devoted with many chapters by Beisert and friends, with many chapters where different aspects of this integrability in ADS-CFT are covered. For example, together with him, I wrote a section where I explain how to derive this dressing factor by solving crossing. Someone else explained how to derive the dispersion relation using symmetry. Someone else explained the construction of the dilatation operator that I covered in the first lectures. So I think now you are ready to study it if you are interested in knowing more about integrability.
Question?
Yes.
Regarding the you taking the L-definitely limit in the Vedian sats, it only appears in the wrapping thing, right? Or because you just said that we are taking L to be infinity. When
we don't need to take L to be infinity. If you take L to be 10, it's fine until you go to order lambda to the 10.
But it only appears at this level.
Yes, only at order. So if you consider operators of order, operators of length 20, you can go up to 20 loops until you get the wrong result. But to some extent, it's a bit even academic. 20 loops is fine for most purposes. Unless maybe you want 300 digits of precision or something. Okay. So now let me comment a bit on a totally different, on a slightly different topic, which is the topic of computing higher point correlation functions, most notably three-point correlation functions in n equals 4 super Young Mills. How would you go about computing three-point functions in n equals 4 super Young Mills? Well, you have your operator, which is your spin chain. And now you have to take three such operators and compute their expectation value. So this would be the expectation value of O1, O2, O3. This is what we have to do. Expectation value of three operators. Each of them is a spin chain. We already found the good operators. All we have to do now that we found them, and by the way, don't forget that when I draw this picture, I should probably add a sum because we have to sum over all possible states. But let me not write the sums, not to clutter this too much. And then, but what is this to leading order? To leading order, for example, I just need to draw propagators between all my three operators. So you see that now for three-point functions, there is a conceptual step, one more ingredient that we need to know. The two-point functions, the deltas, were all about energies of quantum spin chains. That was what it was all about, computing energies of quantum spin chain. But now you see that what you need here is you need to know the details of the wave functions that you are considering. And what you are doing is overlapping states, is taking off wave functions and making inner products of wave functions and doing overlaps of wave functions. So the point is that you see that for three-point functions, we need the precise wave functions. Now, those wave functions, I wrote them down. They are known. They are just the beta wave functions that are written there. So all we have to do is solve this combinatorical problem. And this was done a few weeks ago, and it is given by some ratio of determinants. Okay? So this is at one loop, which means, again, lambda to the zero order, because the one loop states are of order lambda to the zero. Plus lambda times corrections, plus lambda squared times corrections, etc. So this is just, at this loop order, when you just need to contract, this is just a combinatorial problem. Schematically, you just have three wave functions and you just need to overlap them. Okay, is it clear? So I give you three operators and tell we contract all the operators. Now at higher loops, you see that you need to know. So for these guys, we need the two loop wave functions, the two loop operators, and here three loop operators, and so on. But now, let's think a bit about what these guys are when we go to higher loops. Because I hid part of the story. There is this point three, and it's not true that all you have to do is change the dispersion and change the S matrix. That's almost correct, but not exactly correct. Because now, what happens then when we go to higher loops? Well, as we said, this S matrix here starts depending on lambda. You agree? The way we scatter starts to depend on lambda. But now, the potential has longer range, right? So imagine you have two particles. What is the form of the wave function? Well, if they are separated, it's just plane waves, and then there is an S matrix. But what if they are inside the region where it's the interaction range of the potential? What's the form of the wave function there? The answer is it's a big mess. No? If I have a potential, and I have my particles entering the potential, I mean, it's a mess. It's in the interaction region. So this, we only know that it takes this nice form if N1 and N2 are not extremely close. So what you have to add here, we have to add 1 plus lambda, and then there could be a contact term if N2 is equal to N1 plus 1, times a contact term that appears at two loops when the two magnets are close, and that would depend on P1 and P2. Okay? So we also need to add, when we go to higher loops, so for the three-point functions, we also need the point three, which are all these contact terms, say C2, when two particles are close, when three particles are close. At three loops, you could have something when you have one particle, then an empty space, and then another particle, and so on. And you start to have to compute more and more contact terms. Now, note that if you want to compute the energy, you just go to the region where they are separated, and everything is perfect. If you want to impose periodicity, you just impose periodicity, and it's fine. You don't need to go into the interacting region. So for the point of view of the spectrum, who cares about these contact terms? You don't care. But from the point of view of now starting to contract these spin chains, you do need to know everything about the wave function. Is it clear? Because the wave function really knows about these global properties of this spin chain. Now, if you compute this guy, this is very simple. If you compute this one, it's a bit more complicated. If you compute the next contact term, even at two loops, it takes a couple of pages in Mathematica. And actually, no one wrote it down. This is something. We now have the general expression, but it's not published yet. And we started computing these guys, and we see that this is a huge mess. So as I said, this guy, C2, for four particles close to each other, takes a few pages in Mathematica. However, still, when you compute a three-point function, what you find is that, remarkably, you have these ratios of determinants. Okay? You have this result that you compute at tree level. This result, inside this result, we have stuff like u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2 to the L. We have stuff like u minus u prime plus I over u minus u prime minus I, etc. But then, you see, given our experience with the spectrum problem, we can make some guess. Right? So now we make the obvious guess. Just put some X's here and replace this by the corrected S matrix. And now you can say this is insane. You can say maybe if you drop the contact terms, it could work. Because if you drop the contact terms, you are indeed just correcting the S matrix and the dispersion. Maybe it works if you drop the contact terms. You agree? You can say maybe it gives part of the result. If you drop the contact terms, it works. No, it works if you keep the contact terms. It's because of these hugely messy contact terms that the result, up to the loop order that we checked up to three loops, that the result seems to work perfectly. And if you want, this is like experimental. It's an experimental observation. But this clearly indicates that there exists some hidden structure. These miracles that it works, the fact that it has become clear that it works, and there are now many people trying to understand why and propose generalizations and so on, indicates that there exists some hidden structure in all this stuff. And this structure actually becomes more and more clear if we use this formalism that I told you once about, which is called the algebraic Bittan-Zatz. So there is some algebraic structure hidden. And the algebraic Bittan-Zatz is the right formalism for looking for this structure. And you see that right now, if we really know, we'll need the wave functions to any loop order, not only the S matrix that you can find by this argument, not only the dispersion that you can find by symmetry, then you really will need the Hamiltonians, all the Hamiltonians at all loops. Okay? So right now, we start to need new stuff that before we could live without. Now we really need the Hamiltonians, we really need to know what we are diagonalizing, we really need to address this completely new field of trying to understand contact terms in long-range interacting spin chains and so on. So this is something that has been, this is one development that people are trying to follow on. Now, finally, let me end by telling you, what about strong coupling? What's the status of this new direction of trying to understand structure constants at strong coupling? Trying to understand higher point functions what about higher point functions at strong coupling? Now, what do we compute when we compute higher point function at strong coupling? We prepare three closed strings. We prepare three strings that are the three operators that we compute the three-point function of. And my car is downstairs. Okay. So we prepare three strings. And what do? We put them away from these brains in this decoupling argument. And then we will scatter them, and they will interact with the brain. And it's the same story as usual. And then we can replace the interaction with all these brains by them moving in ADS5. So what do we have to compute? We have to find the minimal surface where now you have the boundary of ADS, Z equals 0. And again, the same story. You prepare the strings that you scatter, and they interact with the brains here. In other words, we replace it by an untrivial background, and we need to compute this kind of area. And the result for, in this case, for the three-point function, but you could have more legs, for the n-point function, would go like e to the minus square root lambda over 2 pi times the area of this minimal surface, by the same argument as before. How much is known? What do we know about the area of this surface? Now again, if the Wilson loop one looks hard, this one will not look much easier. You can imagine that it's hard to compute the full area of this surface. There is one case that is known. People compute the area of one such surface. And it's the surface that corresponds to an inner product to a three-point function that is protected by supersymmetry. So it's really equal to one. So that's not really very exciting. So the area is zero. And that's the only area that people computed. There are some advances. Rommel, Dianic, and collaborators, and Kotsam and collaborators computed the part of the area. The surface moves in ADS, but it also moves in the sphere. And they managed to compute, for three-point functions, the part of the surface that moves in ADS. So right now, we have some incomplete computations of half of the area of these surfaces, if you want. There is a complete computation for the case where the surface is like this, where you have a very big operator and the other one is very small, so it can be treated by a probe. Because as you see here, it's very symmetric and you can still manage to compute it exactly. So we have half of the computation for three-point functions. Half of the computation, so it's this ADS part of the result. They computed the ADS part of the result for the structure constants. And here we have the full structure constant for C, 1, 2, 3, where this third operator is tiny compared to the other two. So we don't yet have a full complete result, but I think within a week, João and John should have it. So I'm hoping that they will tell us what it is very soon. So this is exactly what they are now wrapping up. So if I had 5 more minutes, I would tell you that what we saw in this lecture is just the tip of a big iceberg. So we started to see that there is this integrability that allows us, without any doubt, to solve gauge theories. So this was extremely exciting, and it still is. But there was a huge burst of excitement like 2-3 years ago when this was first realized, when people were finding miracles after miracles for the spectrum problem, and when they realized that the spectrum problem could be solved exactly. Right now, I think we are going through another very exciting era, but slightly different in spirit. And now it's the time where not only we understood the spectrum problem, but we understand that integrability is present roughly everywhere. Wilson loops, correlation functions, scattering amplitude is everywhere. And why is it very interesting that it's everywhere? For two main reasons. First of all, because before, we were exploring more or less sharded territory. We were computing energies of spin chains, but our condensed matter friends were already computing energies of spin chains. Not as complicated as ours, but they knew how to compute at least SU2 spin chains. But then, now, you see, we have to deal with completely different things. We have to learn how to tailor spin chains, how to start cutting spin chains and gluing them together, how to solve integrable theories that are not on the topology of a cylinder or space, but which have the topology of a sphere with punctures or torus. So we are now exploring really completely novel territory with respect to integrability. And that's something really very exciting from this point of view. And it's remarkable that n equals 4 seems to really guide us and tell us, look, this is a very good question. Because naively, you see, if you are purely a pure integrabilist, you start computing the structure constants and you give up. You say, OK, this looks very, very messy. But n equals 4 tells you, no, you need a contact term. And they are very messy. But compute some physical quantity like a three-point function, and you will find a miracle. Because this is a physical quantity. It should not be a mess. And you do it, and you find. And you find that they are not only messy, they are very beautiful. And they are needed to get a beautiful result for physical quantities. The other very exciting thing of the last few months, or maybe even years, is that we start, and that's a very, very good sign. How would you How would you know if you are about for the very first time to solve a four-dimensional gauge theory? You would know if you are studying different quantities from completely different point of view, like localization, Wilson loops, amplitudes, and so on, and when you start seeing the same structures, and when you start seeing that, wow, I'm using exactly the same things, say, to compute the area of those surfaces as the techniques that I use to compute the area of the minimal surfaces for the Wilson loops, without knowing their precise shape, but managing to compute their area and so on. And this is highly remarkable. It's like you are digging a mountain from all possible directions and you start hearing the drills when you are in one of the tunnels of the other one. So this really signals that the mountain is going down. So n equals 4 will be solved within the next few years. And that will be a huge achievement for theoretical physics. But when it does, it's a big mountain that goes down, but it's still a mountain above the clouds. And then we have the non-planar limit, and then we have other examples of ADS-CFT and quantum gravity and no supersymmetry and so on. So there are plenty of exciting things to do. Thank you.